basked in the unusual sheepishness of Fat Purse and Glandy Keith. "Listen, yar, how did we know your finger was in the... Hey, man, we got free tickets for a picture tomorrow. You want to come?" And my equally unexpected popularity. "No more Zagalo, solid man. You really lost your hair for something good." Auntie Pier was out. I sat quietly with Uncle Hanif while, in the kitchen, Mary Pereira prepared dinner. It was a peaceful little family scene. But the peace was shattered abruptly by the crash of a slamming door. Hanif dropped his pencil as Pierre, having slammed the front door, flung open the living room door with equal force. Then he boomed cheerfully, "So, wife, what's the drama?" But Pierre was not to be diffused. "Scribble," she said, her hand slicing the air. "Allah, don't stop for me. So much talent. A person cannot go to the pot in this house without finding your genius. Are you happy, husband? We are making much money. God is good to you?" Still, Hanif remained cheerful. "Come, Pia, our little guest is here. Sit, have tea." Actress Pia froze in an attitude of disbelief. "Oh, God, such a family I have come to. My life is in ruins and you offer tea. Your mother offers petrol. All is madness." And Uncle Hanif frowning now. "Pia, the boy..." A shriek, "Ah, the boy! But the boy has suffered. He is suffering now. He knows what it is to lose, to feel forlorn. I, too, have been abandoned. I am great actress, and here I sit surrounded by tales of bicycle postmen and donkey cart drivers. What do you know of a woman's grief? Sit, sit. Let some fat, rich Parsi film producer give you charity. Never mind that your wife wears paste jewels with no new saris for 2 years. A woman's back is broad, but, beloved husband, you have made my days into deserts. Go, ignore me now. Just leave me in peace to jump from the window. I will go into the bedroom now," she concluded. "And if you hear no more from me, it is because my heart is broken and I am dead." More doors slammed. It was a terrific exit. Uncle Hanif broke a pencil, absent-mindedly, into two halves. He shook his head wonderingly. "What's got into her?" But I knew. I, bearer of secrets threatened by policemen, I knew and bit my lip, because, trapped as I was in the crisis of the marriage of my uncle and aunt, I had broken my recently made rule and entered Pia's head. I had seen her visit to Homi Katrak and knew that, for years now, she had been his fancy woman. I had heard him telling her that he had tired of her charms, and there was somebody else now, and I, who would have hated him enough for just seducing my beloved aunt, found myself hating him twice as passionately for doing her the dishonour of discarding her. "Go to her," my uncle was saying. "Maybe you can cheer her up." The boy Salim moves through repeatedly slammed doors to the sanctum of his tragic aunt and enters to find her loveliest of bodies splayed out in wondrous abandon across the marital bed, where, only last night, bodies nestled against bodies, where paper passed from hand to hand. A hand flutters at her heart, her chest heaves, and the boy Salim stammers, "Aunt, oh, aunt, I'm sorry." A banshee wail from the bed. Tragedian's arms flying outwards towards me. "Hi, hi, 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 hi." Needing no further invitation, I fly towards those arms. I fling myself between them to lie atop my mourning aunt. The arms close around me, tighter, tighter, nails digging through my school-white shirt. But I don't care, because something has started twitching below my S-buckled belt. Auntie Pia thrashes about beneath me in her despair, and I thrash with her, remembering to keep my right hand clear of the action. I hold it stiffly out above the fray. One-handed, I begin to caress her, not knowing what I'm doing. I'm only 10 years old and still in shorts, but I'm crying because she's crying, and the room is full of the noise. And on the bed is two bodies thrash, two bodies begin to acquire a kind of rhythm, unnameable, unthinkable, hips pushing up towards me while she yells, "Oh, oh God, oh God, oh!" And maybe I'm yelling too, I can't say. Something is taking over from grief here. While my uncle snaps pencils on a striped sofa, something getting stronger as she writhes and twists beneath me. And at last, in the grip of a strength greater than my strength, I'm bringing down my right hand. I've forgotten my finger, and when it touches her breast, wound presses against skin. Yahoo! I scream at the pain, and my aunt, snapping out of the macabre spell of those few moments, pushes me off her and delivers a resounding wallop to my face. Fortunately, it is the left cheek. There is no danger of damage to my remaining good ear. "Budmarsh!" my auntie screams. "A family of maniacs and perverts! Woe is me! What woman ever suffered so badly?" There is a cough in the doorway. I am standing up now, shivering with pain. Pia is standing too, her hair dripping off her head like tears. Mary Pereira is in the doorway, coughing, scarlet confusion all over her skin, holding a brown paper parcel in her hands. "See, Baba, what I have forgotten," she finally manages to say. "You are a big man now. Look, your mother has sent you two pairs of nice white long trousers." After I got so indiscreetly carried away while trying to cheer up my aunt, it became difficult for me to remain in the apartment on Marine Drive. Long, intense telephone calls were made regularly during the next few days, Hanif persuading someone while Pierre gesticulated that perhaps now, after 5 weeks, and one evening after I got back from school, my mother picked me up in our old Rover, and my first exile came to an end. Neither during our drive home nor at any other time was I given any explanation for my exile. I decided, therefore, that I would not make it my business to ask. I was wearing long pants now. I was, therefore, a man, and must bear my troubles accordingly. I told my mother, "The finger is not so bad. Hanif Mamu has taught me to hold the pen differently, so I can write okay." She seemed to be concentrating very hard on the road. "It was a nice holiday," I added politely. "Thank you for sending me." "Oh, child," she burst out, "with your face like the sun coming out, what can I tell you? Be good with your father. He is not happy these days." I said I would try to be good. She seemed to lose control of the wheel, and we passed dangerously near a bus. "What a world," she said after a time. "Terrible things happen, and you don't know how." "I know," I agreed. "Aya has been telling me." My mother looked at me fearfully, then glared at Mary in the back seat. "You black woman," she cried, "what have you been saying?" I explained about Mary's stories of miraculous events, but the dire rumour seemed to calm my mother down. "What do you know?" she sighed. "You are only a child." "What do I know, Amma?" "I know about the Pioneer Cafe." Suddenly, as we drove home, I was filled once again with my recent lust for revenge upon my perfidious mother, a lust which had faded in the brilliant glare of my exile, but which now returned and was united with my new-born loathing of Homi Catrack. This two-headed lust was the demon which possessed me and drove me into doing the worst thing I ever did. "Everything will be all right," my mother was saying. "You just wait and see." "Yes, Mother." It occurs to me that I have said nothing in this entire piece about the Midnight Children's Conference, but then, to tell the truth, they didn't seem very important to me in those days. I had other things on my mind. Commander Sabamati's Baton. A few months later, when Mary Pereira finally confessed her crime and revealed the secrets of her 11-year-long haunting by the ghost of Joseph da Costa, we learned that after her return from exile, she was badly shocked by the condition into which the ghost had fallen in her absence. It had begun to decay, so that now bits of it were missing. An ear, several toes on each foot, most of its teeth, and there was a hole in its stomach larger than an egg. Distressed by this crumbling spectre, she asked it, when she was sure nobody else was within earshot, "Oh, God, Joe, what have you been doing to yourself?" he replied that the responsibility of her crime had been placed squarely on his shoulders until she confessed, and it was playing hell with his system. From that moment it became inevitable that she would confess, but each time she looked at me she found herself prevented from doing so. Still, it was only a matter of time. In the meanwhile, and utterly ignorant of how close I was to being exposed as a fraud, I was attempting to come to terms with the Methils estate in which, too, a number of transformations had occurred. In the first place, my father seemed to want nothing more to do with me, an attitude of mine which I found hurtful, but, considering my mutilated body, entirely understandable. In the second place, there was the remarkable change in the fortunes of the Brass Monkey. My position in this household, I was obliged to admit to myself, has been usurped, because now it was the monkey whom my father admitted into the abstract sanctum of his office, the monkey whom he smothered in his squashy belly, and who was obliged to bear the burdens of his dreams about the future. I even heard Mary Pereira singing to the monkey the little ditty which had been my theme song all my days. "Anything you want to be," Mary sang, "you can be. You can be just what all you want." Even my mother seemed to have caught the mood. And now it was my sister who always got the biggest helping of chips at the dinner table, and the extra Nargisi kofta, and the choicest pasanda. While I, whenever anyone in the house chanced to look at me, was conscious of a deepening furrow between their eyebrows and an atmosphere of confusion and distrust. But how could I complain? The monkey had tolerated my special position for years, with the possible exception of the time I fell out of a tree in our garden after she nudged me, which could have been an accident, after all. She had accepted my primacy with excellent grace and even loyalty. Now it was my turn. Long-trousered, I was required to be adult about my demotion. This growing up, I told myself, is harder than I expected. The monkey, it must be said, was no less astonished than I at her elevation to the role of favoured child. She did her best to fall from grace, but it seemed she could do no wrong. These were the days of her flirtation with Christianity, which was partly due to the influence of her European school friends and partly to the rosary-fingering presence of Mary Pereira, who, unable to go to church because of her fear of the confessional, would regale us instead with Bible stories. Mostly, however, I believe it was an attempt by the monkey to regain her old, comfortable position in the family doghouse. And speaking of dogs, the Baroness Simke had been put to sleep during my absence, killed by promiscuity. My sister spoke highly of gentle Jesus, meek and mild. My mother smiled vaguely and patted her on the head. She went around the house humming hymns. My mother took up the tunes and sang along. She requested a nun's outfit to replace her favourite nurse's dress. It was given to her. She threaded chickpeas on a string and used them as a rosary, muttering Hail Mary full of grace, and my parents praised her skill with her hands. Tormented by her failure to be punished, she mounted to extremes of religious fervour, reciting the Our Father morning and night, fasting in the weeks of Lent instead of during Ramzan, revealing an unexpected streak of fanaticism which would, later, begin to dominate her personality, and still it appeared she was tolerated. Finally, she discussed the matter with me. "Well, brother," she said, "looks like from now on I'll just have to be the good guy, and you can have all the fun." She was probably right. My parents' apparent loss of interest in me should have given me a greater measure of freedom. But I was mesmerized by the transformations which were taking place in every aspect of my life, and fun in such circumstances seemed hard to have. I was altering physically. Too early, soft fuzz was appearing on my chin, and my voice swooped out of control, up and down the vocal register. I had a strong sense of absurdity. My lengthening limbs were making me clumsy, and I must have cut a clownish figure as I outgrew shirts and trousers and stuck gawkily and too far out of the ends of my clothes. I felt somehow conspired against by these garments which flapped comically around my ankles and wrists, and even when I turned inwards to my secret children, I found change and didn't like it. The gradual disintegration of the Midnight Children's Conference, which finally fell apart on the day the Chinese armies came down over the Himalayas to humiliate the Indian Fauj, was already well underway. When novelty wears off, boredom and then dissension must inevitably ensue. Or, to put it another way, when a finger is mutilated and fountains of blood flow out, all manner of vilenesses become possible. Whether or not the cracks in the conference were the active metaphorical result of my finger loss, they were certainly widening. Up in Kashmir, Narada Markandeya was falling into the solipsistic dreams of the true narcissist, concerned only with the erotic pleasures of constant sexual alterations, while Sumitra, the time traveller, wounded by a refusal to listen to his descriptions of a future in which, he said, the country would be governed by a urine-drinking dotard who refused to die, and people would forget everything they had ever learned, and Pakistan would split like an amoeba, and the prime ministers of each half would be assassinated by their successors, both of whom, he swore, despite our disbelief, would be called by the same name, wounded Sumitra became a regular absentee from our nightly meetings, disappearing for long periods into the spidery labyrinths of time. And the sisters from Bord were content with their ability to bewitch fools young and old. "What can this conference help?" they inquired. "We already have too many lovers." And our alchemist member was busying himself in a laboratory built for him by his father, to whom he had revealed his secret. Preoccupied with the Philosopher's Stone, he had very little time for us. We had lost him to the lure of gold. And there were other factors at work as well. Children, however magical, are not immune to their parents. And as the prejudices and worldviews of adults began to take over their minds, I found children from Maharashtra loathing Gujaratis and fair-skinned northerners reviling Dravidian blackies. There were religious rivalries, and class entered our councils. The rich children turned up their noses at being in such lowly company. Brahmins began to feel uneasy at permitting even their thoughts to touch the thoughts of untouchables, while among the lowborn the pressures of poverty and communism were becoming evident. And on top of all this, there were clashes of personality and the hundred squalling rows which are unavoidable in a parliament composed entirely of half-grown brats. In this way, the Midnight Children's Conference fulfilled the prophecy of the Prime Minister and became, in truth, a mirror of the nation. The passive literal mode was at work, although I railed against it with increasing desperation and finally with growing resignation. "Brothers, sisters," I broadcast with a mental voice as uncontrollable as its physical counterpart, "do not let this happen. Do not permit the endless duality of masses and classes, capital and labour, them and us, to come between us. We," I cried passionately, "must be a third principle. We must be the force which drives between the horns of the dilemma. For only by being other, by being new, can we fulfill the promise of our birth." I had supporters, and none greater than Parvati the Witch, but I felt them slipping away from me, each distracted by his or her own life, just as, in truth, I was being distracted by mine. It was as though our glorious Congress was turning out to be more than another of the toys of childhood, as though long trousers were destroying what midnight had created. "We must decide on a program," I pleaded, "our own 5-year plan. Why not?" But I could hear, behind my anxious broadcast, the amused laughter of my greatest rival, And there was Shiva in all our heads saying scornfully, "No, little rich boy, there is no third principle. There is only money and poverty and have and lack and right and left. There is only me against the world. The world is not ideas, rich boy. The world is no place for dreamers or their dreams. The world, little snotnose, is things. Things and their makers rule the world. Look at Birla and Tata and all the powerful. They make things. For things the country is run, not for people. For things America and Russia send aid. But 500 million stay hungry. When you have things, then there is time to dream. When you don't, you fight." The children, listening fascinatedly as we fought, or perhaps not, perhaps even our dialogue failed to hold their interest, and now I... "But people are not things. If we come together, if we love each other, if we show that this, just this, this people together, this conference, this children sticking together through thick and thin can be that third way." But Shiva snorting, "Little rich boy, that's all just wind, all that importance of the individual, all that possibility of humanity. Today, what people are is just another kind of thing." And I, Salim, crumbling, "But free will, hope, the great soul, otherwise known as Mahatma of mankind, and what of poetry and art and..." Whereupon Shiva seized his victory. "You see? I knew you'd turn out to be like that, mushy, like overcooked rice, sentimental as a grandmother. Go! Who wants your rubbish? We all have lives to live. Hell's bells, cucumber nose, I'm fed up with your conference. It's got nothing to do with one single thing." You ask, "There are 10-year-olds? I reply, "Yes, but you say, did 10-year-olds, or even almost 11s, discuss the role of the individual in society and the rivalry of capital and labour? Were the internal stresses of agrarian and industrialized zones made explicit? And conflicts in socio-cultural heritages? Did children of less than 4,000 days discuss identity and the inherent conflicts of capitalism?" Having got through fewer than 100,000 hours, did they contrast Gandhi and Marx-Lenin, power and impotence? Was collectivity opposed to singularity? Was God killed by children? Even allowing for the truth of the supposed miracles, can we now believe that urchins spoke like old men with beards? I say, maybe not in these words, maybe not in words at all, but in the purer language of thought. But yes, certainly, this is what was at the bottom of it all, because children are the vessels into which adults pour their poison, and it was the poison of grown-ups which did for us. Poison, and after a gap of many years, a widow with a knife. In short, after my return to Buckingham Villa, even the salt of the midnight children lost its savour. There were nights now when I did not even bother to set up my nationwide network, and the demon lurking inside me, it had two heads, was free to get on with its devilment. I never knew about Shiva's guilt or innocence of whore murders, but such was the influence of Kali Yuga that I, the good guy and natural victim, was certainly responsible for two deaths. First came Jimmy Kapadia, and second was Homi Katrak. If there is a third principle, its name is childhood. But it dies, or rather, it is murdered. We all had our troubles in those days. Homi Katrak had his idiot Toxie, and the Ibrahims had other worries. Sonny's father, Ishmael, after years of bribing judges and juries, was in danger of being investigated by the Bar Commission. And Sonny's uncle, Isahak, who ran the second-rate embassy hotel near Flora Fountain, was reputedly deep in debt to local gangsters and worried constantly about being bumped off. In those days, assassinations were becoming as quotidian as the heat. So perhaps it isn't surprising that we all had forgotten about the existence of Professor Shapstecker. Indians grow larger and more powerful as they age, but Shapstecker was a European, and his kind, unfortunately, fade away with the years and often completely disappear. But now, driven perhaps by my demon, my feet led me upstairs to the top floor of Buckingham Villa, where I found a mad old man, incredibly tiny and shrunken, whose narrow tongue darted constantly in and out between his lips, flicking, licking. The former searcher after anti-venins, assassin of horses, Sharpstick Asab, now 92, and no longer of his eponymous institute, but retired into a dark top-floor apartment filled with tropical vegetation and serpents pickled in brine. Age, failing to draw his teeth and poison sacks, had turned him instead into the incarnation of snakehood. Like other Europeans who stayed too long, the ancient insanities of India had pickled his brains, so that he had come to believe the superstitions of the Institute orderlies, according to whom he was the last of a line which began when a king cobra mated with a woman who gave birth to a human, but serpentine, child. It seems that all my life I've only had to turn a corner to tumble into yet another new and fabulously transmogrified world. Climb a ladder, or even a staircase, and you find a snake awaiting you. The curtains were always drawn in Shapstecker's rooms. The sun neither rose nor set, and no clocks ticked. Was it the demon, or our mutual sense of isolation which drew us together? Because in those days of the monkey's ascendancy and the conference's decline, I began to ascend the stairs whenever possible and listen to the ravings of the crazy, sibilant old man. His first greeting to me when I stumbled into his unlocked lair was, "So, child, you have recovered from the typhoid?" The sentence stirred time like a sluggish dust cloud and rejoined me to my one-year-old self. I remembered the story of how Shapstecker had saved my life with snake poison, and afterwards, for several weeks, I sat at his feet, and he revealed to me the cobra which lay coiled within myself. Who listed for my benefit the occult powers of snakes? Their shadows kill cows. If they enter a man's dreams, his wife conceives. If they are killed, the murderous family is denied male issue for 20 generations. And who described to me, with the aid of books and stuffed corpses, the cobra's constant foes? "Study your enemies, child," he hissed, "or they will surely kill you." At Shapstecker's feet, I studied the mongoose and the boar, the dagger-billed adjutant bird, and the barasina deer, which crushes snakes' heads under its feet, and the Egyptian ichneumon and ibis, the 4-feet-high secretary bird, fearless and hook-beaked, whose appearance and name made me think suspicious thoughts about my father's Alice Pereira, and the jackal buzzard, the stink cat, the honey rattle from the hills, the roadrunner, the peccary, and the formidable Kangamba bird. Shapstecker, from the depths of his senility, instructed me in life. "Be wise, child. Imitate the action of the snake. Be secret. Strike from the cover of the bush." Once he said, "You must think of me as another father. Did I not give you a life when it was lost?" With this statement, he proved that he was as much under my spell as I under his. He had accepted that he, too, was one of that endless series of parents to whom I alone had the power of giving birth. And although after a time I found the air in his chambers too oppressive and left him once more to the isolation from which he would never again be disturbed, he had shown me how to proceed. Consumed by the two-headed demon of revenge, I used my telepathic powers for the first time as a weapon. And in this way, I discovered the details of the relationship between Homi Katrak and Leela Sabarmati. Leela and Pia were always rivals in beauty. It was the wife of the heir apparent to the title of Admiral of the Fleet who had become the film magnate's new fancy woman. While Commander Sabarmati was at sea on manoeuvres, Leela and Homi were performing certain manoeuvres of their own. While the Lion of the Seas awaited the death of the then Admiral, Homi and Leela, too, were making an appointment with the Reaper, with my help. "Be secret," said Sharpstick Asab. Secretly, I spied on my enemy Homi, and on the promiscuous mother of Ice Slice and Hair Oil, who, were very full of themselves of late, ever since, in fact, the papers announced that Commander Sabarmati's promotion was a mere formality, only a matter of time. Loose woman, the demon within me whispered silently, perpetrator of the worst of maternal perfidies. We shall turn you into an awful example. Through you we shall demonstrate the fate which awaits the lascivious. Oh, unobservant adulteress! Did you not see what sleeping around did to the illustrious Baroness Simke von der Heiden, who was, not to put too fine a point upon it, a bitch just like yourself? My view of Leela Sabarmati has mellowed with age. After all, she and I had one thing in common. Her nose, like mine, possessed tremendous powers. Hers, however, was a purely worldly magic. A wrinkle of nasal skin could charm the steeliest of admirals. A tiny flare of the nostrils ignited strange fires in the hearts of film magnates. I am a little regretful about betraying that nose. It was a little like stabbing a cousin in the back. What I discovered. Every Sunday morning at 10 a.m., Leela Sabarmati drove Ice Slice and Hair Oil to the Metro Cinema for the weekly meetings of the Metro Cub Club. She volunteered to take the rest of us too. Sunny and Cyrus, the monkey, and I piled into her Indian-made Hindustan car. And while we drove towards Lana Turner or Robert Taylor or Sandra Dee, Mr. Homi Katrak was also preparing himself for a weekly rendezvous. While Leela's Hindustan puttered alongside railway lines, Homi was knotting a cream silk scarf around his throat. While she halted at red lights, he donned a technicolored bush coat. When she was ushering us into the darkness of the auditorium, he was putting on gold-rimmed sunglasses. And when she left us to watch our film, he too was abandoning a child. Toxie Katrak never failed to react to his departures by wailing, kicking, thrashing of legs. She knew what was going on, and not even Biop could restrain her. Once upon a time, there were Radha and Krishna and Rama and Sita and Layla and Majnu. Also, because we are not unaffected by the West, Romeo and Juliet and Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. The world is full of love stories, and all lovers are, in a sense, the avatars of their predecessors. When Leela drove a Hindustan to an address off Colaba Causeway, she was Juliet coming out onto her balcony. When cream-scarfed, gold-shaded Homi sped off to meet her in the same Studebaker in which my mother had once been rushed to Dr. Nalika's nursing home, he was Leander swimming the Hellespont towards Hero's burning candle. As for my part in the business, I will not give it a name. I confess, what I did was no act of heroism. I did not battle Homi on horseback, with fiery eyes and flaming sword. Instead, imitating the action of the snake, I began to cut pieces out of newspapers. From Goan Liberation Committee Launches Satyagraha Campaign, I extracted the letters COM. Speaker of EPAC Assembly declared maniac gave me my second syllable, man. I found DER concealed in Nehru Considers Resignation at Congress Assembly. Into my second word now, I excised Saab from Riots, Mass Arrests in Red Run Kerala, Saboteurs Run Amok. Ghosh accuses Congress Gundas and got ARM from Chinese Armed Forces, Border Activity Spurn, Bandung Principles. To complete the name, I snipped the letters ATI from Dulles Foreign Policy is Inconsistent, Erratic, PM Avers. Cutting up history to suit my nefarious purposes, I seized on why Indira Gandhi is Congress President now, and kept the why. But I refused to be tied exclusively to politics and turned to advertising for the Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavour? But PK Keeps Its Savour. A sporting human interest story. Mohan Bagan Centre Forward Takes Wife gave me its last word. And go-to? I took from the tragic masses go-to Abul Kalam Azad's funeral. Now I was obliged to find my words in little pieces once again. Death on South Col, Sherpa Plunges, provided me with the much-needed col. but Arba was hard to find, turning up at last in a cinema advertisement. Alibaba, 17th Super Colossal Week, plans filling up fast. Those were the days when Sheikh Abdullah, the Lion of Kashmir, was campaigning for a plebiscite in his state to determine its future. His courage gave me the syllable cause, because it led to this headline: Abdullah incitement, cause of his rearrest, government spokesman. Then too, Acharya Vinoba Bhav, who had spent 10 years persuading landowners to donate plots to the poor in his Bhudhan campaign, announced that donations had passed the million-acre mark and launched two new campaigns, asking for the donations of whole villages, Gramdan, and of individual lives, Jivandan. When J.P. Narayan announced the dedication of his life to Bhav's work, the headline, Narayan Walks in Bhav's Way, gave me my much-sought way. I had nearly finished now. Plucking an on from Pakistan on course for political chaos, faction strife bedevils public affairs, and a Sunday from the masthead of the Sunday Blitz, I found myself just one word short. Events in East Pakistan provided me with my finale. Furniture hurling slays deputy EPAC speaker, mourning period declared, gave me mourning. From which, deftly and deliberately, I excised the letter U. I needed a terminal question mark and found it at the end of the perennial query of those strange days. After Nehru, who? In the secrecy of a bathroom, I glued my completed note, my first attempt at rearranging history, onto a sheet of paper. Snake-like, I inserted the document in my pocket like poison in a sack. Subtly, I arranged to spend an evening with Ice Slice and Hair Oil. We played a game, Murder in the Dark. During a game of murder, I slipped inside Commander Sabarmati's Almira and inserted my lethal missive into the inside pocket of his spare uniform. At that moment, no point hiding it, I felt the delight of the snake who hits its target and feels its fangs pierce its victim's heel. "Commander Sabarmati," my note read, "why does your wife go to Colaba Causeway on Sunday morning?" No, I am no longer proud of what I did. But remember that my demon of revenge had two heads. By unmasking the perfidy of Leela Sabarmati, I hoped also to administer a salutary shock to my own mother. Two birds with one stone. There were to be two punished women, one impaled on each fang of my forked snake's tongue. It is not untrue to say that what came to be known as the Sabarmati affair had its real beginnings at a dingy cafe in the north of the city, when a stowaway watched a ballet of circling hands. I was secret. I struck from the cover of a bush. What drove me? Hands at the Pioneer Cafe, wrong number telephone calls, notes slipped to me on balconies and passed under cover of bedsheets. My mother's hypocrisy and Pierre's inconsolable grief. Hi, 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 hi. Mine was a slow poison, but 3 weeks later, it had its effect. It emerged afterwards that after receiving my anonymous note, Commander Sabarmati had engaged the services of the illustrious Dom Minto, Bombay's best-known private detective. Minto, old and almost lame, had lowered his rates by then. He waited until he received Minto's report. And then, that Sunday morning, six children sat in a row at the Metro Cub Club, watching Francis the Talking Mule and the Haunted House. You see, I had my alibi. I was nowhere near the scene of the crime. Like Sin, the crescent moon, I acted from a distance upon the tides of the world. While a mule talked on a screen, Commander Sabarmati visited the naval arsenal. He signed out a good, long-nosed revolver, also ammunition. He held in his left hand a piece of paper on which an address had been written in a private detective's tidy hand. In his right hand, he grasped the unholstered gun. By taxi, the commander arrived at Colaba Causeway. He paid off the cab, walked, gun in hand, down a narrow gully past shirt stalls and toy shops, and ascended the staircase of an apartment block set back from the gully at the rear of a concrete courtyard. He rang the doorbell of apartment 18C. It was heard in 18B by an Anglo-Indian teacher giving private Latin tuition. When Commander Sabarmati's wife Leela answered the door, he shot her twice in the stomach at point-blank range. She fell backwards. He marched past her and found Mr. Homi Katrak rising from the toilet, his bottom unwiped, pulling frantically at his trousers. Commander Vinu Sabarmati shot him once in the genitals, once in the heart, and once through the right eye. The gun was not silenced. But when it had finished speaking, there was an enormous silence in the apartment. Mr. Katrak sat down on the toilet after he was shot and seemed to be smiling. Commander Sabarmati walked out of the apartment block with the smoking gun in his hand. He was seen through the crack of a door by a terrified Latin tutor. He strolled along Colaba Causeway until he saw a traffic policeman on his little podium. Commander Sabarmati told the policeman, "I have only now killed my wife and her lover with this gun. I surrender myself into your..." But he had been waving the gun under the policeman's nose. The officer was so scared that he dropped his traffic-conducting baton and fled. Commander Sabarmati, left alone on the policeman's pedestal amid the sudden confusion of the traffic, began to direct the cars, using the smoking gun as a baton. This is how he was found by the posse of 12 policemen who arrived 10 minutes later, who sprang courageously upon him and seized him hand and foot, and who removed from him the unusual baton with which, for 10 minutes, he had expertly conducted the traffic. A newspaper said of the Sabarmati affair, "It is a theatre in which India will discover who she was, what she is, and what she might become." But Commander Sabarmati was only a puppet. I was the puppet master, and the nation performed my play. Only I hadn't meant it. I didn't think he'd... I only wanted to... A scandal, yes, a scare, a lesson to all unfaithful wives and mothers. But not that. Never. No. Aghast at the result of my actions, I rode the turbulent thought waves of the city. At the Parsi General Hospital, a doctor said, "Begum Sabarmati will live, but she will have to watch what she eats." But Homi Katrak was dead. And who was engaged as the lawyer for the defence? Who said, "I will defend him free, gratis, and for nothing"? Who, once the victor of the Freeze case, was now the commander's champion? Sonny Ibrahim said, "My father will get him off if anyone can." Commander Sabarmati was the most popular murderer in the history of Indian jurisprudence. Husbands acclaimed his punishment of an errant wife. Faithful women felt justified in their fidelity. Inside Leela's own sons, I found these thoughts. We knew she was like that. We knew a Navy man wouldn't stand for it. A columnist in the Illustrated Weekly of India, writing a pen portrait to go alongside the personality of the week, full-colour caricature of the commander, said, "In the Sabarmati case, the noble sentiments of the Ramayana combine with the cheap melodrama of the Bombay talkie. But as for the chief protagonist, all agree on his upstandingness, and he is undeniably an attractive chap." My revenge on my mother and Homi Katrak had precipitated a national crisis, because naval regulations decreed that no man who had been in a civil jail could aspire to the rank of Admiral of the Fleet. So admirals and city politicians, and of course Ismail Ibrahim, demanded, "Commander Sabarmati must stay in a Navy jail. He is innocent until proven guilty. His career must not be ruined if it can possibly be avoided." And the authorities, "Yes." And Commander Sabarmati, safe in the Navy's own lock-up, discovered the penalties of fame. Deluged with telegrams of support, he awaited trial. Flowers filled his cell, and although he asked to be placed on an ascetic's diet of rice and water, well-wishers inundated him with tiffin carries filled with biryanis and pista kalaus and other rich foods. and, jumping the queue in the criminal court, the case began in double-quick time. The prosecution said, "The charge is murder in the first degree." Stern-jawed, strong-eyed Commander Sabamati replied, "Not guilty." My mother said, "Oh, my God, the poor man, so sad, isn't it?" I said, "But an unfaithful wife is a terrible thing, Amma." And she turned away her head. The prosecution said, "Here is an open and shut case. Here is motive, opportunity, confession, corpse, and premeditation. The gun signed out. The children sent to the cinema. The detective's report. What else to say? The state rests." And public opinion, "Such a good man, Allah." Ishmael Ibrahim said, "This is a case of attempted suicide." To which public opinion, "Huh?" Ishmael Ibrahim expounded, "When the commander received Dom Minto's report, he wanted to see for himself if it was true, and if so, to kill himself. He signed out the gun. It was for himself. He went to the Kalaba address in a spirit of despair only, not as killer, but as dead man. But there, seeing his wife, there, jury members, seeing her half-clothed with her shameless lover, jury members, this good man, this great man, saw red, red, absolutely. And while seeing red, he did his deeds. Thus, there is no premeditation, and so no murder in the first degree. Killing, yes, but not cold-blooded. Jury members, you must find him not guilty as charged." And buzzing around the city was, "No, too much. Ishmael Ibrahim has gone too far this time. But, he has got a jury composed mostly of women and not rich ones, therefore doubly susceptible to the commander's charm and the lawyer's wallet. Who knows? Who can tell?" The jury said, "Not guilty." My mother cried, "Oh, wonderful! But, is it justice?" And the judge answering her, "Using the powers vested in me, I reverse this absurd verdict. Guilty as charged." Oh, the wild furore of those days, when naval dignitaries and bishops and other politicians demanded, "Sabamati must stay in the Navy jail pending High Court appeal. The bigotry of one judge must not ruin this great man." And police authorities capitulating, "Very well." The Sabamati case goes rushing upwards, hurtling towards High Court hearing at unprecedented speed. And the commander tells his lawyer, "I feel as though destiny is no longer in my control, as though something has taken over. Let us call it fate." I say, call it Salim, or Snotnose, or Sniffer, or Stainface. Call it Little Piece of the Moon. The High Court verdict, "Guilty as charged." The press headlines, "Sabamati for civil jail at last?" Ishmael Ibrahim's statement, "We are going all the way to the Supreme Court." And now the bombshell, a pronouncement from the state chief minister himself.
"It is a heavy thing to make an exception to the law, but in view of Commander Sabamati's service to his country, I am permitting him to remain in naval confinement, pending the Supreme Court decision."
And more press headlines, stinging as mosquitoes. "State government flouts law. Sabamati scandal now a public disgrace." When I realized that the press had turned against the commander, I knew he was done for. The Supreme Court verdict, guilty. Ishmael Ibrahim said, "Pardon. We appeal for pardon to the President of India." And now great matters are to be weighed in Rashtrapati Bhavan. Behind the gates of President House, a man must decide if any man can be set above the law, whether the assassination of a wife's fancy man should be set aside for the sake of a naval career, and still higher things. Is India to give her approval to the rule of law or to the ancient principle of the overriding primacy of heroes? If Rama himself were alive, would we send him to prison for slaying the abductor of Sita? Great matters. My vengeful eruption into the history of my age was certainly no trivial affair. The President of India said, I shall not pardon this man. Nussi Ibrahim, whose husband had lost his biggest case, wailed, hi, 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 and repeated an earlier observation, Amina sister, that good man going to prison. I tell you, it is the end of the world. A confession trembling just beyond my lips. It was all my doing, Amma. I wanted to teach you a lesson. Amma, do not go to see other men with Lucknow work on their shirt. Enough, my mother, of teacup kissery. I am in long trousers now and may speak to you as a man. But it never spilled out of me. There was no need, because I heard my mother answering a wrong number telephone call and, with a strange, subdued voice, speak into the mouthpiece as follows. No, nobody by that name here. Please believe what I am telling you, and never call me again. Yes, I had taught my mother a lesson, and after the Sabarmati affair, she never saw her Nadia Kasim in the flesh, never again, not as long as she lived. But, deprived of him, she fell victim to the fate of all women in our family, namely the curse of growing old before her time. She began to shrink, and her hobble became more pronounced, and there was the emptiness of age in her eyes. My revenge brought in its wake a number of unlooked-for developments. Perhaps the most dramatic of these was the appearance in the gardens of Methil's estate of curious flowers made out of wood and tin and hand-painted with bright red lettering. The fatal signboards erected in all the gardens except our own, evidence that my powers exceeded even my own understanding and that, having once been exiled from my two-story hillock, I had now managed to send everyone else away instead. Signboards in the gardens of Versailles Villa, Escorial Villa and Sanssouci, signboards nodding to each other in the sea breeze of the cocktail hour. On each signboard could be discerned the same seven letters, all bright red, all 12 inches high. For sale. That was the signboard's message. For sale. Versailles Villa. Its owner dead on a toilet seat. The sale was handled by the ferocious nurse, Bayarp, on behalf of poor idiot Toxie. Once the sale was complete, nurse and nursed vanished forever, and Bayarp held on her lap a bulging suitcase filled with banknotes. I don't know what happened to Toxie, but considering the avarice of her nurse, I'm sure it was nothing good. For sale, the Sabarmati apartment and Escorial Villa. Leela Sabarmati was denied custody of her children and faded out of our lives, while Icelice and Hair Oil packed their bags and departed into the care of the Indian Navy, which had placed itself in loco parentis until their father completed his 30 years in jail. For sale, too, the Ibrahims Sanssouci, because Isahak Ibrahim's Embassy Hotel had been burned down by gangsters on the day of Commander Sabarmati's final defeat. As though the criminal classes of the city were punishing the lawyer's family for his failure. And then Ishmael Ibrahim was suspended from practice, owing to certain proofs of professional misconduct, to quote the Bombay Bar Commission's report. Financially embarrassed, the Ibrahims also passed out of our lives. And finally, for sale, the apartment of Cyrus Dubash and his mother. Because during the hue and cry of the Sabarmati affair, and almost entirely unnoticed, the nuclear physicist had died his orange pip-choking death, thus unleashing upon Cyrus the religious fanaticism of his mother, and setting in motion the wheels of the period of revelations which will be the subject of my next little piece. The signboards nodded in the gardens, which were losing their memories of goldfish and cocktail hours and invading cats. And who took them down? Who were the heirs of William Methold? they came swarming out of what had once been the residence of Dr. Nalika, fat-bellied and grossly competent women, grown fatter and more competent than ever on their tetrapod-given wealth, because those were the years of the great land reclamations. The Nalika women. From the Navy, they bought Commander Sabamati's flat, and from the departing Mrs. Dubache, her Cyrus's home. They paid buy-up in used banknotes, and the Ibrahim's creditors were appeased by Nalika cash. My father alone, of all the residents, refused to sell. They offered him vast sums, but he shook his head. They explained their dream, a dream of razing the buildings to the ground and erecting, on the two-story hillock, a mansion which would soar 30 stories into the skies, a triumphant pink obelisk, a signpost of their future. Amitz and I, lost in abstractions, would have none of it. They told him, "When you're surrounded by rubble, you'll have to sell for a song." He, remembering their tetrapodal perfidy, was unmoved. Nussi the duck said, as she left, "I told you so, Mina sister. The end of the world." This time she was right and wrong. After August 1958, the world continued to spin, but the world of my childhood had indeed come to an end. Padma, did you have, when you were little, a world of your own? A tin orb on which were imprinted the continents and oceans and polar ice? Two cheap metal hemispheres clamped together by a plastic stand? No, of course not. But I did. It was a world full of labels, Atlantic Ocean and Amazon and Tropic of Capricorn. And at the North Pole it bore the legend, "Made as England." By the August of the nodding signboards and the rapaciousness of the Nalika women, this tin world had lost its stand. I found scotch tape and stuck the earth together at the equator, and then, my urge for play overcoming my respect, began to use it as a football. In the aftermath of the Sabamati affair, when the air was filled with the repentance of my mother and the private tragedies of Methil's heirs, I clanked my tin sphere around the estate, secure in the knowledge that the world was still in one piece, although held together by adhesive tape, and also at my feet, until, on the day of Nussi the duck's last eschatological lament, on the day Sunny Ibrahim ceased to be Sunny next door, my sister, the brass monkey, descended on me in an inexplicable rage, yelling, "Oh God, stop your kicking, brother! You don't feel even a little bad today?" And jumping high in the air, she landed with both feet on the North Pole and crushed the world into the dust of our driveway under her furious heels. It seems the departure of Sunny Ibrahim, her reviled adorer, whom she had stripped naked in the middle of the road, had affected the brass monkey after all, despite her lifelong denial of the possibility of love. Revelations. Om Hare Kushro, Hare Kushrovand Om. Know, O unbelievers, that in the dark midnights of celestial space, in a time before time, lay the sphere of blessed Kushrovand. Even modern scientists now affirm that for generations they have lied to conceal from the people whose right it is to know of the unquestionable, true existence of this holy home of truth. Leading intellectuals the world over, also in America, speak of the anti-religious conspiracy of Reds, Jews, etc. To hide these vital news, the veil lifts now. Blessed Lord Kushro comes with irrefutable proofs. Read and believe. Know that in true existing, Kushrovan lived saints whose spiritual purity advancement was such that they had, through meditation, etc., gained powers for the good of all. Powers beyond imagining. They saw through steel and could bend girders with teeth. Now, for first time, such powers may be used. In your service, Lord Kushro is here. Hear of the fall of Kushrovand, how the red devil, Bimutha, black be his name, unleashed a fearsome hail of meteorites, which has been well chronicled by world observatories, but not explained. So horrible a rain of stone that fair Kushrovand was ruined and its saints destroyed. But noble Jura'el and beauteous Kalila were wise, sacrificing themselves in an ecstasy of kundalini art. They saved the soul of their unborn son, Lord Kushro, entering true oneness in a supreme yogic trance, whose powers are now accepted in whole world. They transform their noble spirits into a flashing beam of kundalini life force energy light, of which today's well-known laser is a common imitation and copy. Along this beam, soul of unborn Kushro flew, traversing the bottomless deeps of celestial space eternity, until by our luck it came to our own dunya world and lodged in womb of a humble Parsi matron of good family. So the child was born and was of true goodness and unparalleled brain, giving the lie to that lie that we are all born equal. Is a crook the equal of saint? Of course not. But for some time his true nature lay hidden until, while portraying the earth saint in a drama production of which leading critics have said the purity of his performance defied the belief, he came awake and knew who he was. Now has he taken up his true name, Lord Kushro Kushravani Bhagwan, and is set forth humbly with ash on his ascetic's brow to heal disease and end droughts and fight the legions of Bhimutha wherever they may come. For be afraid, Bhimutha's rain of stone will come to us also. Do not heed lies of politicos, poets, reds, etc. Put your trust in only true Lord. Kushro, Kushro, Kushro. Kushro, Kushro, Kushro. And send donations to P.O. Box 555, Head Post Office, Bombay 1. Blessings, beauty, truth. Om Hare Kushro, Hare Kushrovand Om.
Cyrus the Great had a nuclear physicist for a father and, for a mother, a religious fanatic whose faith had gone sour inside her as a result of so many years of being suppressed by the domineering rationality of her dubash. And when Cyrus's father choked on an orange from which his mother had forgotten to remove the pips, Mrs. Dubash applied herself to the task of erasing her late husband from the personality of her son, of remaking Cyrus in her own strange image. Cyrus the Great, born on a plate in 1948. Cyrus the school prodigy, Cyrus as St. Joan in Shaw's play. All these Cyruses to whom we had grown accustomed, with whom we had grown up, now disappeared. In their place there emerged the overblown, almost bovinely placid figure of Lord Kushro Kushrovand. At the age of 10, Cyrus vanished from the cathedral school, and the meteoric rise of India's richest guru began. There are as many versions of India as Indians, and, when set beside Cyrus's India, my own version seems almost mundane. Why did he let it happen? Why did posters cover the city and advertisements fill the newspapers without a peep out of the child genius? Because Cyrus, although he used to lecture us, not unmischievously, on the parts of a woman's body, was simply the most malleable of boys and would not have dreamed of crossing his mother. For his mother, he put on a sort of brocade skirt and a turban. For the sake of filial duty, he permitted millions of devotees to kiss his little finger. In the name of maternal love, he truly became Lord Kushro, the most successful holy child in history. In no time at all, he was being hailed by crowds 500,000 strong and credited with miracles. American guitarists came to sit at his feet, and they all brought their checkbooks along. Lord Kushrovand acquired accountants and tax havens, and a luxury liner called the Kushrovand Starship, and an aircraft, Lord Kushro's astral plane. And somewhere inside the faintly smiling benediction-scattering boy, in a place which was forever hidden by his mother's frighteningly efficient shadow — she had, after all, lived in the same house as the Nalaka women — how well did she know them? How much of their awesome competence leaked into her? There lurked the ghost of a boy who had been my friend. "That Lord Kushro?" Padma asks, amazed. "You mean that same Mahaguru who drowned at sea last year?" "Yes, Padma. He could not walk on water, and very few people who have come into contact with me have been vouchsafed a natural death.